little bit dressed up. It was a day quite early in my career as a management consultant. I'd had a first career as an economist, so I wasn't completely green. But it was quite a big shift of career to go from that to into management consulting. This was back in 2000. And I was on a project where my manager said, "Caroline, I think you're ready to give the final presentation to the clients at the end of this project." You know, I got my feet wet, I got my feet under the table, and I was settled enough that they thought, right, she's ready to stand up and give the final presentation. Now, you know what that's like. You all remember the first time that you got up and gave a presentation? It's like, okay, I'm gonna really nail it. I was so on top of the content. I was really, really excited about my slides, and I will say, just to date this, that this was the last presentation I ever gave, and indeed the first, on acetate overhead slides. Okay, and half of you are like, what is that? So, it takes a lot of work to get these acetate overhead slides ready, and I had them, they were all stacked and ready to go. But I was a little bit worried about, well, my nerves, actually. I was just worried about how to project gravitas and presence into the room. It's my first chance to give this sort of presentation. And I was mostly doing it by striding about as boldly as I could, pulling myself up to full height, doing all the things that we're now taught as women is a good thing. Stride, stride, pause, gesture. So it was going brilliantly, I thought. I had the room in the palm of my hand. And then there was a moment where I was, you know, being especially emphatic about a particular point. And I took a step, and I heard this noise. I heard a crack. And I don't know how many of you have had this happen to you. How many of you knew what was about to happen to me? Yeah, so I didn't, actually, because it had never happened to me before. It is actually, apparently, entirely possible for the heel on a high heel shoe to break off completely. Which is not something you know until it's happened. So, yeah. As I was lying on the floor, I'm not kidding. It was quite a sort of firm step. As I was lying on the floor, it turned out to be really difficult to project any further gravitas or presence into the room. So, you know, we all have stories like that. We all have bad days that we can laugh about now. Didn't feel great at the time. Mostly it's not wardrobe malfunctions, not at work anyway. It's more often to be tech failures or people malfunctions, dare I say it. So there's plenty of stuff we can't control. That's just in our everyday lives. We look outside our everyday lives, my goodness, right? Sometimes the world feels completely out of control, certainly where it feels right now. But I've always been interested in the wiggle room. What is our scope to act around the constraints that we all face as human beings? When I was 17, I decided my life philosophy was going to be realistic optimism. It's not everything is awesome, but let's be realistic about how human beings behave. And then let's be optimistic about the fact that it's possible to find a way through that and around that so that we can be at our best more often. And my toolbox for that over the years became behavioral science. So this is the neuroscientists, the psychologists, the economists who are interested in explaining why we behave the way we do, why we think the way we do, why we feel the way we do, why other people behave and think and feel the way they do. And thanks to their amazing research over especially the past 20 to 30 years, we've actually got a really, really good sense of what it takes for us to be at our best. And actually, this amazing research that they have put together tells us that there are tiny tweaks that we can make to our everyday routines that actually have quite disproportionate effects on how every day can feel. You still want to think about big interventions, right? Sometimes you just need to make huge changes in your career. But there's a lot of magic in making the everyday feel more manageable, more satisfying, more energizing. And the research that these guys are doing suggests that actually we do have a bit more space to shape our everyday life, our everyday experience of life, more space than we think. And I'm going to talk about four little examples We'll see where I have to point this to. I'm going to talk about four little examples, which, I mean, there are many. There are maybe 100 little examples. But I want to give you four examples of things that we tend to think of as being prefixed. You know, we just have to roll with them. But actually, we've got more control over them, we think. And the first one is reality. How do we improve reality? We'll start with a deep existential question. Right. You may say woo if you like. You know, we're going to hack reality in just a second. So, second is, how do we get more time in the day? How do we create more time for ourselves? So this is very practical to complement the existential point. How many of you would like more time in the day? Right, okay, there we are. Especially if reality is treating us well, right? And then I'd like to talk about something intellectual. So how do you boost your intelligence on demand? All types of intelligence, emotional intelligence, analytical intelligence. How do you just become the smarter version, wiser version of yourself when you're feeling stuck? And then what does it take to remote control other people's moods? Like I'm remote controlling these slides. There is a trick, and we're going to talk about it. So that's the territory we're going to cover as fast as we possibly can. Are you ready? Yes, fantastic. You're doing great, by the way, after lunch. Wow, wonderful. Yes, I might make you stretch in a second. OK, now. Okay, so let's talk about hacking reality. There we are. I think I might have to point it over there, so I'll do a kind of dance move with it. Okay, so dogs in hats. I would like my reality to have more dogs in hats in. I am not sure that I can achieve that for you, but I'll tell you what we do know about the reason that reality is more hackable than we thought. There was a day which was a bit further on in my career, which was another of those days that you remember and you think, not my finest. I was quite senior, actually, at that time. I was on a project, though, that I wasn't loving. So how many of you have something on your to-do list that you're not that excited about? Okay, whisper it, right? That was what I was doing that particular day. I'd actually been put on the project by someone more senior than me who thought that I'd be an amazing compliment to another partner, another senior person. His name was Lucas, and the idea was we were doing this huge transformation project, the sort that maybe some of you are involved in. And Lucas's style was very different to mine. You know, he was the sort of person who would never go into a conversation, even with his spouse, without a 300-page deck. And he would present it. But he was very analytical, very on top of the structure and the numbers and so on. And I was there to compliment him in bringing the people side of things, right? The people side of things. So I saw the point. So this first day, it was the first meeting of the clients. We were supposed to go in and build a rapport with the people that we were going to be serving over the next 6 months on this big project. And I was cranky about being on the project. I was cranky about the way that the room and the whole meeting was set up, because I had quite a strong view that when you're trying to build rapport with someone and trust, it really helps to be face-to-face, doesn't it? Right. We've all been on these sort of interminable video conferences where the tech fails and the conference calls and so on. Anyway, so this was the setup. We had a video conference, and it was a grim room, one of these kind of dark, low-ceiling, you know, not particularly uplifting kind of spaces. We walked in, sitting in a row. Our clients are about 3 feet away from us on this screen. And I know it's not going to be a great meeting. I can just sense it, and I can tell, and I am absolutely right. 2 hours later, I've got a list of all the things that I've noted down about people interrupting each other, people rolling their eyes, sort of genuine sense that kind of there's differences of opinion that have gone unspoken. It's just chafing. I mean, it's not awful. I mean, in the sense that nobody has punched anyone. It'd be hard to, because they're on the screen, so, you know. But there is definitely a sense that this was not the start that we were supposed to have with the clients. So I thought, okay, I've been put on the project to bring the people side of things. So I'm going to sit down with Lucas and say, I think we've got off on the wrong foot with the clients. I sat down with him afterwards and I said, you know, I've got concerns and, you know, I think we should think about what to do about it. And he, as I told him, crossed his arms. His body language was so telling. Crossed his arms and started shaking his head. He said, "I don't know what you're talking about." He didn't raise his voice, actually. He was very calm. He said, "I don't know what you're talking about." He said, "Do you not remember the time when the client said, 'This is a great meeting,' and the time when the other client said, 'This is a good foundation for the work we're going to do together?" I was like, "Hmm." And he said, "Do you not remember that we actually laughed at one point about the silly thing that happened with the coffee?" I was like, I did not disbelieve him. I did not disbelieve him, because it was just on the edge of my consciousness. But it was not my experience of the meeting. And I became very interested in this. I've been looking at behavioral science for some years, but this was a particular area of behavioral science I hadn't looked at that time. And it was fascinating to me how he could have experienced that meeting so differently. And yes, you might be thinking, well, there's a personality difference. But it was weirder than that. It was like he had been in a different meeting. And I became very interested in how our perceptions could have differed so much. And in particular, how he enjoyed himself so much more than I did, right? We're talking about how to have a good day. So the reason that we essentially experienced something so different is down to the way that our brains work. And what you want to know is that the conscious part of your brain is fabulously intelligent. You already know that already, right? Conscious part of your brain is responsible for things you get excited about in a smartphone. It's sort of reasoning, self-control, planning, all sorts of things. But it has capacity constraints, just like your smartphone or your computer. So actually, your conscious brain can only take on board a certain amount of information at any given time. And there are trillions of pieces of data in the room right now. Right now. You know, if you were to think about every sensation in your body right now, that is a piece of data. The way that your big toe on your right foot feels. If you were to look at every hair on the head of the person next to you, and look at it really, really, really closely in a non-creepy way, each strand of hair is a piece of data. The way that the light falls on it is another piece of data. Trillions of pieces of data. Your brain would crash like an overloaded computer if it actually tried to consciously process it all. So what happens, the reason we don't all freak out every single moment of the day, is that subconsciously, our brain is filtering out an enormous amount of what is being said and done and what can be seen around us. And what that means is we're only getting to see a certain part of reality. We think we're objective observers of reality, but we're actually just seeing an incomplete, edited version of it, like as if we're looking down a pair of binoculars and we're seeing what's in focus but missing everything else. And that's happening all the time. It's happening all the time. Now, that is better than it sounds, because it turns out that there is a really important rule for what our brain tends to make sure that we are noticing consciously and what it filters out. Because what it turns out our brains will filter in and make sure that we notice is pretty much anything which resonates with what's already top of mind for us. If you think about what your brain's trying to do, it's trying to say, out of all of this stuff, what is relevant for you, Caroline, to know right now? How is it going to decide that? It's going to decide what's on top of my mind as my goal for the day or for the moment. So there's a study that I like that demonstrates this, because it's quite realistic. It's actually, you know, some people doing their day job. There's a bunch of radiologists at Harvard who were looking through a stack of lung scans, and they were looking for lung nodules. And in the last of the lung scans, there was a plastic gorilla printed, a little picture of a plastic gorilla printed in the last of the lung scans. So given what I've just told you, what do you think? How many of them saw the gorilla? Yeah, I mean, it rounds to nothing in the sense that 83% of the radiologists did not see the gorilla. And that's despite the fact that eye-tracking devices showed they looked directly at it. It wasn't like they were checking their phone. And despite the fact that this little gorilla was not that little, it was 44 times the size of the lung nodules that they were looking for. And it was also fair to say, I think, that these were people who were trained in spotting abnormalities. I mean, not to worry you, but... So, you know, that's how powerful the filtering mechanism can be. You cannot see something or hear something that is in front of you and around you. Why was it that they didn't see the gorilla? They weren't expecting to see the gorilla. I mean, you know, did you think they sat down in the morning and said, I'm going to look for gorillas, right? So they didn't have gorillas top of mind. And that is enough for them to actually be able to miss the gorilla. Now, with that in mind, it's not really that surprising, is it, that if I go to the meeting with Lucas and what's top of mind for me is an assumption that it's going to be a terrible meeting, and I'm feeling a bit crappy about the whole thing. I'm also not a morning person, didn't have enough coffee, all sorts of things playing into this. I was not in a good mood. And the thing that you need to know is it's not just kind of, I'm looking for an object, therefore I will see the object. It's more subtle than that. If I take you as an audience and have you all sign up for a psychology experiment in my lab, and you all agree to take a test, which I give you. It's a random little test, not a big deal. But I decide to put half of you in a bad mood by telling you that you failed this silly little test, right? No biggie, but I mean, you're bigger than that. And yet, it would kind of rile you a little bit, right? You guys, you're fine. You pass the test. And then I give you all a description of a neutral individual. It's carefully written to be neutral. This description of an individual. You have to all tell me how likable you think this person is. So what happens? You think that this guy's perfectly likable. You guys, because you're in a bad mood, perceive this person as less likable. So our starting point becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. Our brain takes our aims, our attitudes, our assumptions, and says, let's look for information that matches that and that confirms that. So you might know the phrase confirmation bias. Confirmation bias is one subset of selective attention. But here's the enormous opportunity, right? Because if our starting point has a huge effect on what we're going to see, we can be a bit more deliberate about the filters that we choose to apply, the perceptual filters that we choose to take into a situation. So I turned up to that meeting, and I was in a bad mood, so I was going to see everything that confirmed that I was right to think it was going to be a terrible meeting. Lucas showed up looking for collaboration, looking for ways to move the project forward, right? So what did he see? He saw them. I mean, he didn't invent them, he just saw them where I just blanked them. And this is what's so powerful for us, because we have the opportunity to be more deliberate as we go into any conversation that's perhaps a bit high stakes or a bit stressful, any task, any interaction, any day, and be more deliberate about what's top of mind as we take ourselves into that. So instead of spilling coffee on ourselves in the morning and then being in a bad mood and then everybody being a jerk that day, you've ever had one of those days? Right, that's what we call getting out of bed the wrong side. This is the science behind that. There's a trick, which is to say, okay, I notice that I'm not in a great mood. Well, what really matters to me more here? Like, what is the bigger point of what I'm doing right now? If I'd been in Lucas's meeting and had applied this, I would have said, well, the whole idea is to bring the people dimension. So I could look for ways to kind of bridge perspectives, different perspectives, or I can make sure that everybody gets their voice heard. I could have checked my attitude and known that, okay, I can't just say I'm in a wonderful mood, but I can say, is this serving me right now? And can I park it? I can check my assumption that a video conference is just always terrible. Yeah, I'm sure we'll figure it out. If the tech fails, you know, we'll manage. And then if you do nothing else, just saying, what do I want to notice? Where do I want to put my attention? Can be enough to redirect your brain's attentional filters. And that's something that you can use if you're in the middle of the meeting and it's gone horribly wrong. And the whole idea of setting your filters, you're like, I heard that woman say something, but I didn't do it before I came into the meeting because I was busy. And here I am, and it's going south. What can I do right now? I can decide to look for something I can learn from this situation. And actually, that's what I was able to do when I was on the floor. I didn't know the science behind it then. When I was on the floor, I was able to say, with my shoe in two pieces, do I want to get up and notice all of the looks on people's faces that suggest that they think I'm an idiot for having my shoe disintegrate on me? Or do I want to get up and look for all the smiles that suggest that they think I'm human and that this is actually perhaps a good thing that they see that I'm human too. And I did. I got up and I thought, I'm going to look for the humor in this situation. It's where I'm going to direct my attention. I got up and it enabled me to carry on. Not the best of days, but not the worst of days either. So this is a very subtle shift that we can make in everything we do. I'd like to pause for a second, give you a moment to process, and talk to the person next to you about one way that you might use this with the thing you're least looking forward to doing in the next couple of days. It could be a conversation with a family member. It could be something that's going on at work. Just take 1 minute to process this and think, how would I use this? Which of these questions might I like to use? So is this one of those moments where I need to say, what am I going to choose to notice? So were you not able to hear anything I was saying? Oh my God. Well, yeah, I have to say, one of the things that is great about the work that I do is whenever anything goes wrong, I think, oh, how can I use that story? All right, I don't know, could you increase the volume, maybe? All right. Okay. How does this look? Yeah, okay. Is that better? Maybe if I just kind of like speak like that. Held. All right. I think it's attached. Okay, no, but I think I'm really glad one of you said something. All right. Okay, so have you picked a question that you might want to use? I don't know, so the TLDR, the too long didn't read version of this is, everything you think you know, you don't know. Everything you see and you hear is just a small portion of what is around you at any given time. And the way that your brain works, what you actually get to see and hear is strongly determined by your starting point as you go into anything. So your mood, your goals will determine what you'll brain decides is relevant enough for you to see. So if you go into a journey, a commute, and you're in a bad mood, you're going to see everyone who really, really confirms that the world is a terrible place. If you force yourself to say, you know what, okay, fine, it's not been a great morning so far, but I'm going to decide to notice three good things in the next 5 minutes. You can do it even through gritted teeth. When you decide to notice three good things, maybe it's someone helping someone else with a bag. Maybe it's someone else, I don't know, with a nice hat or a nice jacket. Maybe it's just actually making your train on time. If you take a moment to notice those things, you put those things top of mind, then strangely, your brain then says, oh, well, she seems to want to see good things, and therefore you then see more good things. So it's a very, very nice quick hack. The hand mic is attached, I think. Oh, okay, all right. Okay, is it on? Is it on? Okay. Strangers in the night. I don't know, I always get this urge when I get a handheld microphone. So the thing is that we've got a lot more control over the way that our days feel. This is one of the reasons that Sean Aker earlier on was talking about. All right. Yes, I'm just going to hold it like that. Is that all right? No, if I put it on here, then it wasn't. Hold the mic. Okay, all right. Okay. Thank you. All right. Oh, my God. All right. Well, this is a new one on me. Excellent. All right. So where was I? Right, so this is one of the reasons Sean Aker was talking about gratitude earlier on. This is one of the reasons that gratitude is so powerful. If you take a moment to think about what you're grateful for, it's not just happy-clappy voodoo stuff. It's the fact that you've got now good things top of mind, which means that your brain says, oh, you seem to want to see good things. I see. Okay, well, then I'll make sure you see more good things. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy, and that's one of the most powerful things I think I use every day, I would say. Because there's always something that annoys you. All right, shall we move on? All right, okay, I'm gonna get you to do some talking in a second. Okay, how can we make time go further? Which at the moment, given the amount of time we've just lost to microphone challenges, is gonna be a very useful thing. I'm gonna get you to demonstrate how to make time go further, and you may already have read this, so it's kind of fun to see in a large group. I'm gonna ask you to count to seven out loud. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. As fast as you can, on my mark, with some energy. In fact, if you want, you could stand up. Why not? Yes, why don't you stand up? There we are. I find that people can go faster when they're standing up. Okay. So, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Are you ready? Go. Okay, that's awesome. That's awesome. All right. Now I'd like you to do the same, but with letters. So A, B, C, D, E, F, G, as fast as you can, with some panache, with some penwomen panache. A, B, C, D, F, G, as fast as you can, on my mark, go! Awesome. Now, I'd like you to do something that should take the same amount of time put together, which is to mix them up. A1, B2, C3, and so on. Okay? What? Are you ready? You're so ready. Oh, I know you're ready. Go! What happened? Actually, there's a woman at the front who said, oh, God help me. Okay, thank you very much. Give yourselves a round of applause because you have just, without the help of a laboratory, demonstrated about 30 years worth of research into the way that the brain handles multitasking. Yay! Yes. Just to highlight it, so did you find yourself making more mistakes when you did it separately or mixed up? Were you faster when you did it separately or mixed up? Okay. So the thing is, that's true. That's exactly true, what you just discovered. The research is really clear that when we try and do more than one thing at once that requires conscious attention, we think we're super busy. Like, you know, this guy with all of his devices. But actually, we are slowing ourselves down by at least 30%, depending on which study you look at. We take 30% longer to do two things that we're trying to do in parallel versus doing them separately. And we make between 2 and 4 times as many mistakes. In the real world, actually, what that means is you have to go back and fix the mess that you caused by not being perhaps as on top of your game in terms of your judgment. And, you know, that really slows you down, right? Michelle Obama was talking earlier on about the challenges of technology. This is definitely part of, you know, the life that we lead. And thank goodness, don't get me wrong, I am a very pro-technology person. Remember that I was doing acetate overhead slides. I'm very grateful for smartphones. But the truth is that we're bombarded by information the whole time. And the truth is that that is not how our brain is designed to work. We are actually not able to do more than one thing at once. Not consciously. So what our brain is doing when we think that we are doing things in parallel is actually switching off letters, switching on numbers, switching off numbers, and so on. And in each of those switches, which are so tiny you're not even conscious of them, it takes a bit of time and mental energy, and that's what adds up to the hit to our performance and our productivity. So, if you just do a tiny bit more single tasking, you will see an enormous, enormous improvement in your ability to work through things intelligently and quickly. And I know that's hard because we are so on all the time. But I would say, you know, think about what you can do around the edges, around the constraints that you have, right? Realistic optimism. You know, it might not be easy for you to go offline for very long, but maybe there's something that's important, your most important task of the day. What would it take for you to get 10 minutes of really good thinking time that's unimpeded by interruptions? And you think, maybe I can't even manage 10 minutes. Okay, well, what about 1 or 2 minutes? You know, it's just a question of really understanding that this is going to improve your performance and your productivity, getting jiggy with your airplane mode and closing down tabs and putting on huge headphones. And, you know, this is a part of our armory in the modern world to be as effective as we can be when we're at our best. That said, there are a couple of things that I think it's worth mentioning that I think are really helpful when you're trying to think about how do I get just a bit more single tasking into my day. And one of them is to know about the fact that it's going to be easier for you to do more single tasking, doing more of one thing at a time, if you can also think about how you might batch together similar tasks in your day. You look at your day, you've got a certain amount of flexibility, probably not that much in your schedule. But to the extent that it's possible to say, what if I were to blitz my email 2 or 3 times a day? Maybe stay online as much as you need to between, but really blitz it 2 or 3 times a day and gather those batches together, you will get through your email more quickly because you're not asking your brain to switch mode all the time. And to the extent that you can kind of, instead of grabbing 2 minutes here and there to think about a project that requires real thought, say, you know what, I'm going to say this needs an hour, and I'm going to gather that thinking time together. And you can do the same with calls, you can do the same with other types of tasks, with research and so on, over time. You can't do it immediately. But the more you can kind of say, you know what, this is a good chunk of time where I could kind of maybe jiggle my schedule a bit, ask this person whether they can move a meeting or two to combine tasks together. The other thing I would say is it's really nice if you can kind of be kind to yourself, because you know how that awful feeling of saying, I'm going to single task for 5 hours, and then you manage 5 minutes, and you feel bad about yourself. That kind of happened to me. I quit my job to write the book, and I thought I knew about how to multitask. And actually, I was really struggling with being on my own much more than I'd ever been before. And suddenly, you know, the cat videos were way more tempting. So I noticed that, you know, I'd say I'm going to work 90 minutes on a chapter, and then my hand would start crawling towards the mouse to kind of open up everything again. And I was like, oh, for heaven's sake, okay, fine. Then I've only got 5 minutes of single tasking time in me. Set a timer, make it for 5 minutes, let it count down to 0, let it beep, let me feel good about that. And then what we now know is that that's the neurochemistry of reward is going to motivate us to go further. So it's much better to set that tiny goal of 5 minutes, succeed, feel amazing, and want to do more, than to set a goal of saying 90 minutes and then feel terrible because you don't do it. So take a moment to think about what you might do to get 5 more minutes single tasking time in your schedule tomorrow. And take a moment to tell the person next to you what you might do. All right. Let me rudely interrupt your very focused conversations. I will say one of the reasons I'm making these little pauses, even though you think, oh, that's not long enough to have a proper conversation with my new best friend who's sitting next to me, is because I know that it improves recall dramatically. You are way more likely to remember what we're talking about and perhaps act on it if we actually take a moment to reflect. 23% more likely, actually, from one particular study. So there we are. A little bit of a brain hack that I'm playing on you right now. Okay, so we get more time in the day by more single tasking. Let's talk about boosting your intelligence on demand. So you're all very smart. You know that there are days when you really are firing on all cylinders, and you're in the meeting, and you say the clever thing or the witty thing, and everyone says, yeah, good comment, Caroline. Yeah, excellent. Really funny. And then there are days where the amazing, witty, insightful, funny comment comes to you 2 hours later in the restroom. Oh, I should have said. So we know that there are days, there are things that get in the way of us being as great and as brilliant as we can be. And I'm going to talk to you about one little thing that you can do when you're feeling stuck and worn down. Either you're tired or you're facing work or a situation that is a bit too challenging to see a way through. I'll tell you, this came to me a bit further on in my career when I decided that the work I really, really enjoyed was working with senior teams and boards and helping them lead an organization, helping them be more than the sum of their parts. I loved this work. I ended up falling into conversations quite often, one-to-one conversations with leaders who were, you know, and they got quite personal. And they would start to say, you know, my career, I don't know what I'm doing with my life, my marriage. I was like, oh my God. I don't know whether I'm psychologically equipped to actually help you with this. I'm not sure whether I'm doing you psychological damage. I need to get some training. So I thought I need to get certified as a coach as a sort of add-on to what I was doing. So I did. I went on a course. It was amazing. It was kind of a sweet disaster, actually, because The sweet bit was that I absolutely loved the course, and I realized that I was born to be a coach and had to be a coach, and that this was my true calling in life. And this whole management consulting thing, I mean, what was I thinking? The only problem was that I was working for a management consultancy. The disastrous bit was that actually, genuinely, I was very scared of quitting. I knew that what I wanted to do didn't fit with what my firm did, McKinsey, the management consulting firm. But I couldn't see a way to actually be a coach and be, you know, and to keep my job. And I was also very nervous of the financial implications, because I know that being a coach, you work on your own, work is much more up and down, and oh my goodness. So I was quite stressed about this. I mean, you might say, okay, well, you know, you had a wonderful job, you went on a course, which was wonderful also, and now you want to follow your passion, you know, poor you. But it was a bit of a dilemma, and perhaps you've had this sort of career dilemma in your life as well at times. And so the way it works is on coaching courses, those of you who've trained as a coach, you'll know this, is you actually have to practice. You practice your coaching on other people. And there was a woman who was on the course with me called Jill, and she needed that day to practice her coaching on me. So I needed to actually suggest a real topic that she should coach me on. So she said, "What's on your mind, Caroline? You know, I've got 20 minutes to practice on you." And I said, "My career is on my mind. Solve my career." And she said, "Oh, no." So she said, "Okay, no, fine. All right, so what is the problem?" So I described the problem. The fact is, I wanted to be a coach, but I couldn't see how it would fit with my current job, and therefore I was going to have to quit, and I was scared of that. And she said, "Okay, take a deep breath. Tell me what the ideal situation looks like." And I said to her, I was a bit pissy. I said, "If I knew what the ideal situation was, then I wouldn't need to talk to you about this." You know, I was something huffy and kind of, you know, nonsensical. But she said, "No, stay with it. What would the ideal look like?" And then I started to describe what it would look like to be somehow magically a coach working one-to-one with people in this company that did no one-to-one work. And I was like, well, you know, my colleagues would bring me in and they'd ask me to coach their clients, and somehow magically there'd be enough work and then I'd keep my job. And as I was starting to talk about it, I was having quite a lot of fun about, you know, talking about what this would look like. And then she said, "Okay, Caroline, what is the very first step that you could take towards that?" And of course, it was blindingly obvious. At that point, I should tell everybody that's what I wanted to do. I was going to quit, so what did I have to lose? And you're looking at me like, that's obvious. But the thing is, it wasn't obvious to me when I was in the middle of dealing with the problem. It was only obvious to me when I started thinking about the ideal. And there's a reason for that. And it goes back to the fact that our brains are always scanning the environment for possible threats to defend against and rewards to seek out and discover. Right? And when we are more focused on threats, that's what I call defensive mode, and when we're more focused on rewards, that's what I call discovery mode. And there are a couple of things you really want to know about this. The first is that it takes vanishingly little to actually be treated by the brain, our brains, as a threat. Anything, doesn't have to be someone about to punch you, it can be anything that challenges your sense of self-worth. You know, anything that makes you feel that your competence, your autonomy, your purpose is in question. Or undermined in any way. And, you know, that could be someone leaving you off an email chain or interrupting you in a meeting. It could be simply feeling out of your depth on a task, on a topic, on a dilemma. That can be enough to kind of say to your brain, there's a threat here. Second thing you want to know is that, unfortunately, when your brain feels stressed, it becomes dumber. Yeah, it's unfortunate. It turns out that when you put people in a brain scanner and you show them even mildly upsetting pictures, there's less activity in their prefrontal cortex. And their prefrontal cortex is where our more sophisticated neural networks sit, the ones that are responsible for kind of clever thinking, reasoning, self-control, planning, that sort of thing. So in other words, you know, while your brain is busy doing a fight, flight, freeze response, there's less mental energy left over to kind of think things through clearly. So if you can get your brain more focused again on the rewards in a situation rather than the threats, it becomes a lot easier to think more clearly, because you're literally redirecting your mental energy back towards your more sophisticated ability to think. And that's what she was doing so, so brilliantly. She was, yeah, exactly. So she was asking me a positively framed question, which forced me to think about a sense of possibility and a sense of control. Just to remind you of the question that she asked. She said, what's the ideal outcome here? And what's the first small step towards that? And that gave me back a sense of self-worth, because it just made me feel like, oh, okay, something is possible here, and I might be able to actually tackle it. There are others that I love too. When have I previously solved something like this? And what does that tell me I could do now? And where are things working well? And what can I learn from that? And the thing about these questions is that if you use them in a meeting, you immediately sound like the wisest person in the room. You say, yes, so just to step back for a moment, you know, so what is the ideal outcome that we're really going for here? And what would be our very first small step towards that? It is a recipe for reducing tension and improving thinking, whether you're on your own or whether you're with a group of people. So just take a moment now to write down whichever one of these you most like, or take a photo of it so that you can apply it to whatever is most on your plate right now. And when you've decided which one you most like to try, give me a self-satisfied nod. Okay. All right. So I want to finish by talking about other people's moods. Because it's really hard to have a good day if other people are kind of in a bad mood around you, isn't it? I will say it worked, what Jill got me to think through. It actually worked. I went back to my company. I said, you know what? I want to be a coach. I told everybody I could think of telling. Within 2 weeks, I had enough people coming to me saying, I think we could use you on our projects. Can you come in and do this and do that? Can you come in and coach all of my colleagues? Can you come in and coach my clients? That actually worked out, and I stayed another 7 years in my job. So that was nice. Then there was this day that this had worked out, so that I was coaching four attorneys, and it was in Paris, France. And they were a little group of four, and the way it worked was that I was their coach, but they were also coaching each other. And the nice thing about that is, you know how brilliant you are when you give other people advice? Yeah, so that's because you're not threatened by other people's problems, right? So it's much easier to be in discovery mode when you're talking about other people's problems. So this coaching circle is really nice because people were able to help each other really effectively. So this was going really well. It was a lovely session. Three of them were there. One person was late, which was fine. But the thing that was not fine was how she came in when she did come in, which was like this. It was like, slam door. Throws down into chair. So annoying. When's the next session of these? Oh, that's so annoying. I can't make it. Why wasn't that? I consulted on the day. Oh my God. So she was obviously quite stressed. I watched as the stress just rippled off her, and it infected the other three guys. They were like, that's so annoying. Get my phone out too. Yeah, that's really annoying. I can't make the date either. I knew they could make the date because we talked about it. So what I was experiencing there was an extreme example of something that you know and I know, which is that our emotions are really strangely contagious. We're actually wired to be deeply social, as Brené Brown was saying earlier on. She was talking about spirituality, the fact that we are wired to think of something beyond ourselves as well as ourselves. And, you know, one of the neurological components of that is the fact that we are very, very leaky as individuals. We pick up other people's emotions. And within 5 minutes, our emotions sync up, even if we're not speaking to each other and even if we're not working on the same thing. Remarkable. That's certainly what was going on here. So here we are. I've got a split second to think. I've got my toolbox of behavioral science. I'm like, okay, this is contagion. I can see it. She's contagious, so am I, bitch. I didn't say that. I thought, okay, fine, okay. So I need to project something more positive into the room. I had a split second to think. It was Paris, it was Valentine's Day. What was the positive emotion you think I tried to project into the room in that instant? Yes, it was love. Another thing I did not say out loud was, I did not say I'm about to project love at you suckers. These hard-bitten lawyers. No, I felt my feet on the ground. I, sort of in a way, a micro-meditation. I thought about everything I loved about working with them. I really tapped into the love that I had for working with them, which was, you know, was real, it was considerable. It wouldn't have worked if it was fake, to be clear, right? But I actually really did have such fondness for them. I threw in, I will say, an image of my husband's face just, you know, in my mind's eye, just in case that didn't work. But it kind of worked. It kind of worked. Within a few seconds, there was a sort of settling. Within 30 seconds, it was definitely different. And then we were able to get back on track. Now, you might say, yeah, but there's only so long that someone can keep going, right? There's only so much you can stay at that level of annoyance. But the thing is, she might have calmed down. But if I'd projected my angst into the room, what would have happened? It would have escalated again, right? It would have kept things tense. The other thing that you might say is, when someone's being such a pain in the ass, how can you just say project love at them? I mean, it's not really very scientific, Caroline. Well, it turns out, actually, there's something that really helped me in that moment, beyond just knowing I was going to be contagious, which is to say that I knew that she was probably not a terrible person. There's something called the fundamental attribution error in psychology, which tells us that if I show up and I'm cranky at work, I know that it's probably because I slept badly last night. But if you turn up and you're cranky at work, I think you're a horrible person. In other words, sorry, you're lovely. But in ourselves, we know that bad behavior is down to bad circumstances. In other people, we attribute bad behavior to bad character. That's the attribution error. And we all make it. But it really helps to know that only 1% of the population is a psychopath. So, with that in mind, the chances are that when you encounter bad behavior, it's because of bad circumstances. Something has put them on the defensive. Something has put their brain on the defensive. They're juggling a ton of stuff. Maybe their cat vomited on them this morning, right? You don't have to become their psychotherapist. Just thinking about some silly, possible, benign description of a cause for their behavior can help to shift your behavior towards them. Help to shift your demeanor without saying anything. And in shifting the space between you, you can set the conversation in a more positive direction. So, just to recap, tiny, tiny things that take just a couple of seconds. And I'm not saying there isn't more to say, but these are a really good starting point. You can shape your intention, you can shape your reality by being more deliberate about what you have top of mind as you go into anything. You can make the hours go further by doing even a little bit of single tasking. Using those positive framing questions to be your most brilliant, insightful self and to help others be that. And then helping everyone behave better by assuming good person, bad circumstances when you see some really crappy behavior in front of you. And if you can do all of those things a bit more often and a bit more systematically, you are going to have more good days and your good days are going to be better. And the way we spend our days is the way we spend our lives. So I hope this helps. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everyone. Let's give Caroline another round of applause. Thank you
for being part of my next, oh my God, I can't believe this happened to me story.
So we don't have time for Q&A because we need to get Caroline down to the exhibit hall, but she will be there signing her book. So if you have any questions, please come visit her there. And thanks for spending time with us this afternoon.